people know, in this period of his life, you don't have a huge amount of writings. You don't have a Grundrisse that's unpublished or anything like that. But we have thousands of pages of notebooks, research notebooks that he took on a variety of topics. But a lot of them deal with peripheral societies, peripheral to the centers of capitalism, non-Western societies, pre-capitalist societies, and with gender. But I want to talk about it in terms of new terrains of revolution, because I think that Marx is always, I don't think he's ever doing pure research to solve a puzzle, as academics like to say, about like what the origins of capitalism was or something like that, you know, a la Max Weber. But in other words, all history is contemporary, I think somebody said.
Croce.
And all of
Benedetto Croce. In Italian.
okay, but I think even earlier. But all right, all right. Connected to new terrains of revolution, I'm going to argue, but we don't have all the information to always make that argument airtight. Okay, in Capital, 1867, in Communist Manifesto, we have a model of revolution. Capitalism centralizes. It drives people into the cities, they become the workers, they work in these gigantic enterprises. So you have centralization of capital, you have centralization of this large oppositional force of the working class in dialectical relation. As it says at the end of Capital Volume 1, or the penultimate chapter, the negation of the negation sets in and the expropriators are expropriated. And with this dialectical thunderclap, the new society is ushered in a free and associated labor. Also in this, especially in the Communist Manifesto model, this new type of society birthed in Britain spreads outward, smashes over these barbarian walls and pushes its way everywhere. Now, one way to think about this is that this is a model posed at a very high level of abstraction. Because he never says in the manifesto, for example, Irish and English workers uniting together, even though he's very, very aware, even then, of Ireland, of the ethnic divisions inside of Britain, over that. So I think we can call this an abstract model of capitalism in the sense that there is never a chemically pure capitalism, because the first line of Volume 1 of Capital is, those societies that are dominated by the capitalist mode of production, but no society is ever 100% dominated by the capitalist mode of production, nor is any working class pure, or that's not even a good word, nor is any working class unaffected by all these kinds of social divisions and complications. So I just want to get that out of the way. I think that's a model, it's a tendency of what's happening in capitalist society, but it never gets there, and it probably never will get there exactly in the way that he's talking about in the manifesto or the end of Capital. When he gets down to actually analyzing actual working classes, actual capitalism in particular context, it gets much more complicated. So I first want to look at, well, that was my first one. My second point is ethnicity, race, what we might call social status, although Marx never uses that term, but social divisions that have that kind of character similar to what race has in the United States are as both impediments and also possible sparks of revolution. So both, because it's dialectical. So in his late writings, how does this work as impediments? Well, I think everybody knows, some in this room probably by heart, some of what he says about the Irish and the British workers. I hinted at that, but he really puts a point on that in 1869-70, a couple years after Volume 1 of Capital is first published, that the secret of the preservation of the English working class, of the English ruling class, is the antagonism between the Irish and the British workers. So he has that down. He even says in there, in that same thing, about it's very similar to the antagonism between the poor whites and the former slaves in the U.S. South. He says that explicitly, and there's also other writings, of course, during the time of the Civil War in the United States. Even in Capital, there's a couple lines in 1867 about that. But what people don't know, a lot of people know that he was writing notebooks about India and what's today Sri Lanka, Indonesia, North Africa at the end of his life. Most people, unless they happen to read the Heather Brown's book or the last preface to my, the second preface to Marx at the Margins, probably don't know because it's never been published in any language, including Russian or German, the notebooks on ancient Rome. How many people know about those? Well, at the same time he's taking notes on India, he actually has a notebook that's full of reflections on India and Algeria. It's based on Kovalevsky. But in the physical, if this were like a spiral leaf notebook, there would be like 20 pages of notes on Kovalevsky in India. Then he would go, oh, well, for whatever reason, he started reading a book about ancient Rome and the social divisions there, writes 10 pages of notes on that, then goes back to writing notes on the anthropological study of India. So in this, one of these ones on Rome, he gets interested in a... Is that going to stop? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess people can hear me, I hope. He gets into class divisions. I mean, of course he's interested in ancient Rome. So he reads a book about 2nd century Rome, before the modern era, during the period of some slave revolts. But they're not the Spartacist revolt. There's some other revolts, very large, that happen in the early part of the 2nd century. He's really interested, it seems, in is that these revolts are taking place at the same time of what some people probably know about more, the Gracchi brothers, one after the other, try to represent the plebeians against the patricians and are assassinated, and that revolt of the plebeians fails. But that helps pave the way for the end of the Republic and the eventual empire. So he looks at that, and of course, what is he interested in? He's interested in why the plebs and the slaves, even though they're having an uprising at the same time, that they can't unite, and he sees this as the reason why the Roman ruling class is able to stay in power. In the middle of this, now most of these notes is just taking down quotes and so on, but this is not in the author he's reading. Like the poor whites of the American South, he says about the free proletarians of Rome. Or he doesn't even say like, he says the poor whites of the American. He realized there's not a racial, this is not a racial division, but it's a state, for lack of a term, it's a status division. And I call your attention to the fact that the 15th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, says race, color, or previous condition of servitude, because condition of servitude is a very negative status marker in any society. There's one supporter of the Gracchi's who travels out to Anatolia where these slave revolts are taking place, and it's unclear if he ever has anything to do with that, but he's very interested in the fact that this guy travels there. Okay, so those are three things: race in America, the Irish in Britain, and the Roman plebeians and slaves and those social divisions. Okay, another thing that's been well known since 1884, when Engels published Origin of the Family, is at the end of his life, Marx devoted attention to the book of Lewis Henry Morgan on indigenous societies, and then used that to talk about ancient Greece and Rome, and looking at gender as the first social division, a major social division, so forth. Now here, a lot of these notes that Marx takes are about gender, and I'll go down a little bit on that now. So these notes on Morgan, and those who read Engels' book, know that this is about a wide range of cultures from the ancient Iroquois, from the Iroquois in the United States, were still in existence, although very decimated. But within the recent historical memory, there was a lot of new data on them. The ancient Greeks, ancient Romans, trying to draw conclusions about that and their pre-class societies, trying to reread Greek mythology and so forth. So looking at ancient Greece, ancient Rome, the Iroquois, and a variety of other cultures, and the gender divisions, and seeing gender as really foundational to class society. There's argument about this, and I can't go into it here, but whether Engels, how reductionist Engels is in terms of seeing private property, the state, and gender domination by patriarchy arising at the same time or being entirely intertwined, or whether there are patriarchal domination is already starting in these pre-class, pre-state societies. Okay. Now, there's notes on Henry Sumner Maine, who was a great anthropologist and legal theorist of the time, kind of almost like uncelebrated today. He's like kind of a Bernard Lewis type figure. But he was one of these people who was this British administrator in colonial India and was noticed that these societies there was a communistic or collectivist structure in the villages more than in Western Europe. He was very concerned with that, but the book Marx reads by him is actually taking that that insight about India and connecting it to Ireland. So a lot of Marx's notes on Maine are about pre-British Ireland, the clans, the female chieftains, but really mostly the change in position as it evolves towards some type of class society in terms of who owns the herds of cattle, who owns and controls the land, and so forth. But he also emphasizes that when the British come in, it's not that society isn't already going in a patriarchal direction, although that the British deepen that, and the British legal system that comes in is completely patriarchal in terms of property ownership and succession. Then the notes on Algeria, very similar. It's not that much on gender, and that most it's about the difference between the Arab, the Turkish, and then the French domination, taking away communal property. He makes a big point about how this taking away the communal property happened in various stages of French and Algeria from the 1830s onward. But right about the time of the Paris Commune and after it's defeated, the Versailles Assembly, obviously they're very worried about communism. But there are speakers that say, you know, we've got communism in Algeria and we've got to therefore privatize more of the land and put it in the hands of the French. So he kind of sees these two, at least there's implication that he sees these two types of communisms, or at least he's saying the ruling classes see these two types of communisms as twin threats, if you will. And Maine, Henry Sumner Maine is the same thing. He thinks this will never be able to modernize India as long as they have this communal types. And Max Weber says the same thing in his notes on the Russian Revolution in 1905, by the way, and why Russia is so backwards, as he sees it. Also on Rome, there's a number of notes, but there's a historian named Ludwig Vlanger, who's not that well known today, but it's a book about the history of gender in the family in ancient Rome. Marx reads this, makes extensive notes on this. He quarrels with the guy because he's already read Morgan by this time. So Lange is reading the male-headed family all the way back to the very earliest pre-class society, and he's quarreling with him over that. But what he seems to be most interested in is the changing position of women in Rome as it moves from the pre-state society to the republic to the empire. And this is a here we have a point where the Roman, at least he seems to stress that and which Morgan was also talked about, that in Rome as opposed to Greece, because Aristotle basically says that women, it sounds like a little like Saudi Arabia, like women should stay home. If they're on the street, they should have someone accompanying them. If you read Aristotle's Politics, Rome, at least for the aristocratic women, they could, ride around in carriages and so on, and participate to some extent in public life. But on paper, there was still this type of thing of a tutelage, this guardianship, as they call it. In other words, if a female didn't have a father or an older brother or a husband, they assigned someone. Because, like, say she inherited money when her husband died. Well, she was not, she didn't have full legal rights or legal capacity. So therefore, you know, someone had to, like, but this eroded over time as more and more wealth is concentrated. These fortunes are rather large that some of these guardians are administering. And so, and as the state, you get more of state law, the women get the right to go to court. The guardian is stealing my money, you know. So therefore, they actually, the relationship reverses a little bit, at least according to this stuff Morris is reading. And so the women have that, these guardians become more the employees of these aristocratic women. So he's interested in, of course, if you believe that, then you have to disagree with Engels that there was a world historic defeat of the female sex in 10,000 BC that was unmitigated and will not be solved or even changed very much until we get socialism. And there's nothing we can do about it until we abolish capitalism. Okay. Oh, so how does this connect to revolution in his own day? Now, with the colonial India, Ireland race, I think it's pretty clear. Here it's less clear. I mean, there is a comment in the Paris, a civil war in France about the women in the forefront of the struggle in the Paris Commune. There is that thing I mentioned about the French, at least the French dominant classes worried about the relationship of communism in Algeria to communism in France. And there is this thing, very brief, that when the Algerian law, I mean, not that the Algerian law in the time of the Turkish domination is that great toward women, but women have some rights of inheritance and so forth. That disappears when the French law comes in. But it's not, there's no smoke. I wish there was smoke and gun in Marx's late writings that said, you know, just as the Russian villages could be a fulcrum for revolution, women's movements or gender division, social divisions would become a spark for revolution. He doesn't, there's nowhere where he says that. But why he's studying all this, I think he must have been interested in contemporary issues as well, somehow. Okay, and then from periphery to center, where does revolution start? Does it start in places like Britain or France and spread outward to Poland, Ireland, China, so forth? Or can it spread in the opposite direction? There's various indications, even very early, that he thinks it could reverse itself from what we could call that abstract model I mentioned at the beginning. Like in 1863, when Poland rises up, he says, well, maybe this time the lava will flow from east to west, because they're having this pretty large revolutionary movement that goes on for about a year before the Russians can crush it. But it doesn't, it's just a sentence. But Ireland, 1869-70, is where he really develops this a little bit in this long thing against Bakunin, but there's a couple pages in it on Ireland, a confidential communication, if you know it, where he says that Ireland could be the lever for European-wide revolution, that a national revolution against landed property, because it's an agrarian society, and it might be able to break out there first, because in addition to landlord-peasant grievances, they have national grievances. That would be an added, so that could, Ireland could blow. That could maybe, he says, that, well, the revolution might start in France among the proletariat, but then it would spread to England. The implication is also that the Irish working class inside Britain, that an Irish revolution might change some of those relationships that the Irish have toward the British, or the attitudes that the British have toward the Irish. But he doesn't say that directly. But this idea is Ireland as a lever. The second one that's going from east to west is Russia. There's various indications at various points in his writings, 1877 to 82. He does take notes on Russia, too. He'd learned Russian by this time. Those notes on India that I was mentioning, he's reading a Russian book and then taking notes on German. So his Russian is actually quite good by the late 1870s. So Russia, I think, as a lot of people know, they're the communal villages. They can be a spark for revolution in the Communist Manifesto preface of 1882. If it links up with the Western working classes, but it could be the starting point for a European-wide communist revolution. Now, there's also notes, and this is what I want to conclude with, there's notes on Latin America, brief, that have never been published except in German or Russian, to my knowledge. They're part of this set of notes on India. And so in the middle of this, talking about villages in Mexico and Peru, okay, in the 16th century under the Spanish, he says, yeah, by the middle of the 16th century, the rural община had already ceased to exist in many parts of Mexico and Peru. Well, the община is the word for the Russian. It's the Russian word for the village commune. And the natives, but however, the natives, quote-unquote, preserve a lot of these forms nonetheless, even though some of the economic basis of it has receded. He says the same thing in India, where it's much more atomized, because the British have really come in and privatized landed property, put money taxes on peasants under the Cornwallis arrangements. But this is a quote, nevertheless, among these atoms, certain relationships endure. So it's not completely atomized, so some of these communal forms and structures. And also the resistance, Shivaji is a big hero of Indian nationalism, fought against the Mughals. There's a central train station that the terrorists attacked a few years ago in Mumbai. That's the Shivaji train station. Shivaji, the British source that he's reading calls him king, but Marx just changes that, clan leader. This is a clan, more communal. It's not a kingdom. So conclusion is that there's a lot of writings on communal structures, on gender. These in many cases are related to prospects for revolution in his own time. On the Ireland thing, we have a smoking gun, which is that he actually says in a letter to Engels and to another letter, some of, I've changed my position on Ireland. I used to think the British would have a revolution and it would spread to Ireland. Now I think the reverse is true. We don't have anything like that on India because, you know, in the manifesto, he seems to suggest that societies like India and China are asleep and they're awakened by capitalist colonialism, and then maybe later on, way down the line, something might happen in a positive way to them. But part of what we don't have a context for these writings as much as I wish we do. Engels moved to London in 1869. So we don't have those almost daily letters anymore. Engels makes daily visits to the house. Kovalevsky, the anthropologist he was reading on Algeria and India, there is correspondence. They were friends. Kovalevsky gave him Morgan's book. That's how he found out about Morgan's book. There's letters from Marx to Kovalevsky, but the police were nosing around St. Petersburg, and Kovalevsky was away, so his friends decided to go into his apartment, take away all the radical stuff, including these letters from the Red Doctor, and they burned them. So we don't have those letters. So I'll end there. Thank you.
Come in, please. There is some more space for everyone who is stuck at the door. Sorry, Kevin, for the disturbance behind you.
Yeah.
It's working now. Shall I?
Yes. The PDF.
Yeah. Okay.
There are two.
Do you
copies.
Want to sit here? And I
yes.
Yeah.
So then I will move. Unless the computer could be moved.
No, I don't. I'm a bit scared.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. All right. Take care.
Is that it?
Yes.
This one?
Forever Young Short.
Oh, sorry.
This is the PDF.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, this one.
Yeah.
It happens.
Okay.
Yes. Take care.
Oh, wow.
I have such a soft voice, I worry
so
that
people
can hear me. I always worry that my students say, he doesn't speak well.
Okay. Okay.
I bet people heard. Very interesting. And now I will just do the
full.
Okay.
Yes, in many, many years I've seen that the custom is that the philosophers speak, reading papers, and economists, unfortunately like me, presents slides. I decided to sublate this thing. I will not reading, but you will see that my slides will be a bit unusual for those who don't know me. The paper has had many incarnations, so some of you here have already heard it. So I apologize for that. This is a very old cartoon by Altan. A customer goes into a bookstore and asks, "I would like to buy Marx Capital." And the seller answers, "Shall I wrap it up or shall I burn it here?" The situation is not very much changed. My exposition, let us say differently than expositions of people that I respect, like Michael Roberts, etc., is not very simple. I am a fan of the expression of Einstein that everything should be explained as simple as possible. The point is as possible. And as Marx says, there is no royal road to science. Of course, here, one of the problems is the relationship with Hegel. In the paper, you find a sort of methodological introduction. I will not say very much about that. I said something yesterday in the discussion with Roberts. I just give you the titles, mostly. I go into the meaning of the notion of critique, which for me is very different than from criticism. They are two different things. Marx, as in the subtitle, provides a critique of political economy, so we should go into the distinction of political economy and vulgar political economy. Here, my point is, what is missing in classical political economy? An answer is the duality of labor, concrete and abstract, but then we have the problem of understanding what is abstract labor. The second is, of course, the form of value, but as you will see, I distinguish the value as form in the commodity. In the commodity, we have value as content and value as form, not only use value, from what is the form of value, which is exchange value. Then we have the distinction between labor power and labor in capital. But I think that labor must be intended in three ways, not only two. Labor power, labor which means always living labor. In my view, when Marx, in the second edition at least, when writes Arbeit means living labor. But the third is living labor power, or that is human living labor power, the workers as bearers of labor power. And fourth, there is in political economy no theory of capitalist crisis. If I would go into method, and there is something in the introduction, we should see that Marx's method is not only intra-theorical, but has a practical dimension. You can't have a critique of political economy, as Val Suchting said, without a prior practical critique in the early labor movement. Practice is within the notion of science of Marx, going to the second thesis on Feuerbach. And third, there is the way in which he exhibits, he has an exposition of the system, but as Alfred Schmidt said in the late 60s, this is and must be oriented to the practical transformations towards liberation. If you don't have this and you don't deal with the problem, which this have, even today, you don't have a critique of political economy. Another argument that I have is that if you want to be like Marx, that is being a Marxian and not a Marxist, you need to do like him. He would not repeat what he said. He never left even the beginning of Capital. He had many, many, many changes every time he wrote it. But also you must ask, what is political economy today? And I don't buy the argument that political economy died in 1830. There is a political economy of the 20th century, for me, yes, and it is the monetary streams of the 20th century, mostly. And the second or third question, probably, that you have to ask is there are important changes in capitalism today relative to what Marx saw, and my argument is yes. So any strictly orthodox reading can be accepted as Marxian in my way. This is another cartoon from the book of Walt Suchting on Marx. There is Mao encountering Marx, and he says, when they are died, both died, yes, I've read your book, and Marx answers is, really, how did it end? No, you know, this is the point. In the methodological part, I distinguish the pure reading Marx and seeing how many ambiguities and contradictions and incoherences are there, and interpretation, that is trying to choose a way to read Marx according to Marx. This was a famous expression by Cesare Luporini. I think that this must be attempted, but I think that this does not resolve, unfortunately, the contradictions. So I more like the expression by Hans-Georg Backhaus, we have to read Marx against Marx. My point is that reading Marx against Marx, we have to go beyond Marx and deal with the critical political economy of today. Now, I will go into a very quick survey, mainly on book one, on volume one. I will probably, for reason of times, will be cut out at chapter 7, but I will see where we arrive. They are the most important chapters in my view. I will be here again very, 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 very quickly. The commodity we know is dual, use value and exchange value, which means use value and value. At the beginning of Capital, absolute value seems, it is a shine, not to be there in the commodity. It is a semblance that is not be there. Value is a ghost. The ghost must take possession of a body to actually come into being. It is a Gothic novel. It does take possession of a body in Marx's early chapters, in the body of gold as the money commodity. Money is value embodied. Marx does not have for abstract value the expression labor embodied. It has for money as value embodied. When you are there, you have this that for Marx, he was wrong probably, but I don't care about that, was expressing an Hegelian crazy idealistic position. At this point you have, when you have money as money, as if besides lions, tigers, hares, and all other real animals, also the animal existed, the individual incarnation of the whole animal kingdom. It is the first edition of the first volume of Capital. Actually, Hegel has an expression which is exactly the opposite of this, that the animal cannot exist. The point is that the crazy idealist, Hegel, was for Marx enlightening about what actual capitalism is. Actual capitalism, at least part of it, is this one. If I had time, I would show that in this analysis from value to universal equivalent and then to money, abstract labor can be expressed, this is a felicitous expression of Michael Heinrich, as the exposed socialization of private labors fully accomplished in circulation. Distress is, some others authors say, is Benetti and Cartelier, the unity of production and circulation. But as I read the first chapters in Capital, there is a very different line of thought. At the same time, in the first chapters, you have a movement from the inner to the outer, from production to circulation. So actually, value is an expression. Abstract labor itself is an expression going from the inner to the outer. So how can you have the idea that abstract labor comes into being only in circulation, and this idea that you have something already social in production, which is expressed there? My answer is that this is true because the idea of money as a commodity is essential to these marks. In the commodity, we have various form and various content. But the commodity, when we are not in the page 2 of Capital, but just a few pages later, it has a price tag when it is produced. The price tag is in money. It is ideal money. And this ideal money is gold. The relationship between the value of money is given, says Marx, from an originary barter, unmittelbare Produkten Austausch. My pronunciation may be completely false. The value of money is given from an original barter, so we already know in the price tag how much labor is contained in the commodity. Then you have the passage to real money, money as embodied labor, money as money. So Marx is absolutely coherent. If you buy the theory of money as a commodity, unfortunately, I don't buy it. So a problem here, it is opened. Let's move. The problem is what, in many authors, in different forms, is a sort of two worlds view. In production, there are non-homogeneous, non-commensurable entities. Society is only there after production. Then you go to chapters 4, 6, where the problem is how money as money, which is a chrysalis, Marx is also an entomologist, turns into that nice thing which is a butterfly. How money is generating more money. How money is begetting money. At the beginning of chapters 4, you have this expression according to which Marx says capital must be understood as an übergreifendes Subjekt, an overgrasping, dominating subject. It is circulating in a spiral. Value is neither commodity as such nor money as such. It moves from one form to another. As Backhaus rightly says, it is the ens realissimum. It is ethereal in a sense, but it is the real thing. So Marx is also a theologian, but I can go into other details here. The point is that money as value becomes money, money becomes money as capital only when this nice thing, which is the chrysalis, actually does not turn immediately into a butterfly, but it turns into a vampire. And we are in chapter 7. By incorporating living labor power into the lifeless objectivity of the commodities, which serve the commodities as the building material for a new product, the capitalist transforms value into capital. The full quote was before. If an animated monster which begins to work as if its body were by love possessed. How this is done? Because capital, which is dead labor, has to embody, in another meaning than before, the living human as living bearers of labor power and extract in class struggle in production this living labor. I don't know why, in every translation, the lebendige Arbeitskraft einverleibt is translated wrongly. The power, living labor power, always becomes living labor for some reason. Here there is a specific social problem that, in my view, in capitalism with laborers as formally free and equal subjects, which is an illusion which is, however, powerful in reality. The problem is that capital encounters a specific social problem to extract living labor from these workers, which may resist in some way. The answer by Marx is that new value, in which there is surplus value, is generated because actually what is capitalist production? The consumption of workers, the consumption of the human living bearers of labor power. This is a view of exploitation, which is not a distributive view, which is something which unites me and Massimiliano Tomba. You have to go into his book, which is Marx Temporalities in English. For years, for decades probably, I quoted this as if his body were by love possessed. It is even in the title of a paper of mine, and I said, oh, what a poetic expression. Then I realized that it is a quote from Goethe, and it is a rat which has been poisoned, and it is dying. And then this frantic movement, as if its body were by love possessed. So we moved from the ghost to the chrysalis to the butterfly, but behind the butterfly we have the vampire, we have Frankenstein, we have the rat dying. Capital is dead labor, which vampire-like lives only by sucking living labor, and lives the more about itself. If I would have time, I could show here everything about Marx. There is even one error, but in decades I've not been able to correct it because I don't have the program, the people who gave me does not have the possibility to change, etc. I should have to go more in chapter 7, where there is the origin of labor power. It is done by a method of comparison, a counterfactual hypothetical reasoning between two situations, one in which living labor is just equal to necessary labor, but then there is the generation of surplus value through surplus labor because there is a prolongation of living labor over and above necessary labor. All Marxists, with the exception of Croce, was not a Marxist, of Rubin, of Sraffa in a note in 1940, and of Varoufakis in chapter 4 of his textbook, see, understand how this argument is developed, even in forms that literally I don't accept. That is, Varoufakis has a very humanistic reading. And in fact, Croce and Rubin does not have the prolongation, have a kind of minus wage theory of the origin of profit. I have 3 minutes, so I just say this. I don't go into the extraction of absolute value and relative surplus values, just say that in the extraction of relative surplus value, well, Marx realized that he had to include competition in the book one of Capital, but not the Ricardian competition of equalization of profit rates among sectors, but the competition within the sector. There was an author who plagiarized Marx, but he said that, and he was Schumpeter. This kind of competition, in my view, must be stressed by Marxians to understand that the equalization of profit rate is just an ideal tendency, not really producing the notion of the center of gravity. Then there are the chapters 13, 15 in Italian, I think they are 15, 17 in English, but I don't know, in which there is simple cooperation, manufacturing division of labor, machino factor, the real subsumption of labor to capital. There, some things happen.
It's 13 to 15.
It's 13 to 15. Good. The first thing is that the notion of abstract labor is enriched. Now we see that all workers are immediately socialized by capital. It is exactly the same German term you don't get in many translations because it is translated differently: collective, communal, etc. So, what is the real subsumption of labor capital, machine of factor, what happens in capital? Two completely new things that never existed before. You have immediately socialized worker in production, but that labor is not immediately social labor in circulation. That's pretty strange. And then you have an idea of what communism could be for Marx, an immediately socialized workers, which is immediately social. This is related to the notion of technology in Marx. The fact that living labor is manipulated in production as if it were a thing. But I don't have the time to go into that. I just want to say that in chapter 25, and in general, in the section on reproduction, we see that what Marx has been doing in Capital was to construct a macro social class monetary theory. When you are in section 7 on reproduction, you are not speaking of single workers, single capitals, but you are speaking of capital as a whole versus the working class. Marx is explicit that here there is a macro logic which was not anticipated before. It is a logic which is unique and opposite to the micro logic before. Of course, macro and micro are an anachronism. I could translate in the point of view of totality, individual, but I want to be strong here, because what Marx is saying, that what was he presented as phenomenal manifestation before, Erscheinung, now is revealed to be an illusory semblance. So, workers were free and equal subjects of bargaining on the labor market. That was an Erscheinung. It was not wrong. It was true from that perspective. But now you see that actually the relationship between workers and capital is a relationship of slavery. It is a necessary objective illusion. If you read this section, you see that Marx here anticipates the political economy of the 20th century, not in the full details, but he anticipates the view of the capitalist process as a Kreislauf, a circuit of monetary capital. Marx says in chapter 23, capitalists advance money drafts to workers who gave them back to get their lot of the product. And in the results, I'm closing, he says, it is not the workers that buy the means of subsistence, but the means of subsistence that buy the workers as living labor power. I had long discussions with my friends of ISMT because we were reading the Grundrisse, these results in the translation of the Penguin. And unfortunately, means of subsistence was translated as means of production. So it was not that the means of subsistence, but the means of production that buy the workers as living labor power. I close it here. Okay. I think now you have to...
Thanks.
You have to change, or you know how to do that.
Yeah.
You are young then. So.
So hello everybody, I'm Paula Rauhala from Finland, University of Tampere. Jan Hof writes, Marx's critical theory of fetishism has become a central point of reference for a modern understanding of Marxism, which is represented by intellectuals who wish to distance themselves from the antiquated dogmas of traditional Marxism. I have had a look at the literature which appeared on the occasion of Capital 100 and Marx 150 in Germany, and the theme of fetishism is at the most central place in the West, but not in the East. And so I'm now asking why this is the case. I suggest first, which is pretty obvious, that this is a continuation of the Western Marxist reading of young Marx. And second, also pretty obvious reason must have been that it helped to explain the destructive nature of capitalism, even if the working class in West Germany seemed to be doing fine. The students around the Frankfurt School were willing to make a revolution, but the workers were much less so. And in such a situation, repeating over and again that the workers are exploited anyway wouldn't have been so interesting. And thirdly, I ask that in West Germany in 1968, did the emphasis on this concept not only point towards the West, but also towards the East? Anyway, I argue that there were good reasons for this emphasis on this concept in West Germany in the 60s. And I also claim that today another kind of reading is needed. In this reading, concept of fetishism is not primary in Capital. For Marx, the phenomenon of fetishism is important in capitalism because it helps to veil exploitation. And this reading is today again more appealing because after the disappearance of the global challenger, the challenger of global capitalism, it is returning back to the business as usual, and then therefore talking about exploitation of labor has become much closer to common sense than it was in the 60s. So in order to understand why this kind of reading of Capital arose in 68 West Germany, I will make an overview to this historical situation which differs from ours. West Germany around 68 was characterized by the Cold War, not in the form of communism, but in the form of anti-communism. So it set challenges for Marxist research. The Communist Party of Germany, KPD, was banned in 56, and Social Democratic Party, SPD, erased the rest of its Marxism from its program in its party congress in Godesberg, 1959. Its student organization, Socialist German Student Union, SDS, did not accept this and was finally expelled from the party, and the split was completed as SPD entered into a great coalition with Christian Democrats in 66. And SDS, on its part, formed the strongest force of the so-called extra-parliamentary opposition. So the students of SDS brought Marx to the universities. They relaxed the highly elitist academic culture, and they also, of course, did everything to spread the revolt outside of the universities. Before the high point of the student movement, Marxism was little present in West German academic discussion. In 67 and 68, a number of important books on capital appeared in the East and the West alike. And generally, it seems to me that fetishism is a huge theme in the literature in the West. And this is especially the case in Frankfurt among the students of Adorno, of course. For instance, Hans-Georg Backhaus explains later on that all of his writings have dealt with one and the same problem, fetishism. So let us have a look at the conference organized on the occasion of 100th anniversary of Capital in 67. It was organized in Frankfurt am Main, and there a former student of Adorno, Alfred Schmidt, presented a very influential reading of Capital. This was very interesting and peculiar conference because here the Marxist researchers from Frankfurt and elsewhere from the West had a really rare opportunity to discuss with the Marxist economists from the East, from GDR. And there was an interesting discussion after Schmidt's paper that I want to have a look at. So Schmidt explained that the objectified appearances of our labor govern us in capitalism. So our own actions become objectified into a second nature which starts to govern us. And then he said that in communism there would not be any forces existing independently of us, and none of Marx's categories would apply anymore. A political economist, Karl Bichtler, from East German Academy of Sciences, was of a different opinion. He said that it is a fact that individuals act in unpredictable ways, and that as an aggregate result of their actions, certain economic laws emerge. If this was not the case, we would not need political economy, he claimed, and we could go home from this conference. So in other words, East German Bichtler claimed that also in socialism, laws and forces which are independent of economic actors still exist. And philosopher from Frankfurt, on his part, said that so far, being has determined consciousness, but in communism it should be the opposite. So the discussion leads me to think that commodities were produced not only in the Western side of the Berlin Wall, but also in the East. And then the question arises into a which degree where, I quote, the social relations between individuals in the performance of their labor disguised under the shape of social relations between the products of labor. So in GDR, a big part of consumer goods and intermediate goods were produced as commodities for sale. And even if the law of value was considered to be valid and operating, the system itself was not considered to be commodity production. This is because in commodity production, the allocation of resources happens exposed, and in planned economy, it was supposed to be the task of the central planners. And therefore, instead of commodity production, they talked about commodity money relations and utilization of commodity money relations for the purposes of planning. There is a typical joke, GDR joke, on this issue. Somebody asks, will there be commodity money relations in communism? The answer is, money, yes. Commodities, not really. But the relations are the most important. So, I'm now asking, is the strong emphasis on the concept of fetishism among the Frankfurt School also motivated by the disappointment towards state socialism? I don't know. But anyway, in difference to this tradition of reading Capital, I find it useful to differentiate between fetishism in commodity production in general and fetishism which is specific for capitalism. And therefore, I now move to the concept of fetishism in Capital, and I claim that Marx does not talk about fetishism which is specific to capitalist mode of production in the first three chapters of Capital, but only after the fourth chapter, only after he has introduced capital and labor market. So as you all know, in fetishism of commodities, the social relations between individuals appear as relations between things. And you also know that in money fetishism, a social relation between producers appears in an objective form in money. So I claim that these forms of fetishism are common to all forms of commodity production. I bet that you all have read what Marx writes towards the end of the fetish chapter. I quote, "The mode of production in which the product takes the form of a commodity is the most general and most embryonic form of bourgeois production. It therefore makes its appearance at an early date in history. Its fetish character is comparatively easy to be seen through. When we come to more concrete forms, even this appearance of simplicity vanishes." And all of these more concrete forms are related to capital and wage labor, as we read Capital further from this first part. So even if Marx has unveiled the fetishism of commodities and money, the formula of the circuit of capital MCM prime appears as a mystery. Capital, because it is value, it has acquired the occult quality of being able to add value to itself. It brings forth living offspring. So Marx, of course, does not accept the fetishistic explanation that money grows by itself, but he reveals the production relation of capital and wage labor behind this apparent monetary relation. He writes, "The appearance of products as commodities presupposes such a development of the social division of labor that the separation of use value from exchange value, a separation which first begins with barter, must already have been completed. But such a degree of development is common to many forms of society. Otherwise with capital, the historical conditions of its existence are by no means given with the mere circulation of money and commodities. It can spring into life only when the owner of the means of production and subsistence meets in the market with the free laborer selling his labor power. So exploitation is the social relation behind this occult quality of the original quantity of money to increase in value. And the key in understanding the valorization of the originally invested sum of money is that the money is invested in two different kinds of things, in constant and variable capital, means of production and labor power. So in distinguishing between constant and variable capital, Marx can differentiate between value produced by labor and value that the worker receives and spends on her means of consumption. Classical political economy could not see the essential difference in the two parts of the invested sum of money. So it does not differentiate between different functions of living labor and dead labor in production, but it makes the difference only according to the mode of circulation of the part of capital in question. So the part which circulates piecemeal is called fix, and the part which circulates all at once is called circulating. So classical political economy reasoned that labor is a part of circulating capital together with raw materials because these start circulating with the product, while machinery is fixed capital because it physically stays in the factory. And Marx comments that this brings to completion the fetishism peculiar to bourgeois political economy. Then, when we move to the production of absolute and relative surplus value in the chapter, of course, in the first volume of Capital, but Marx comments in the chapter on the Trinity formula in the manuscript of the third volume, he writes, "We have already demonstrated, in connection with the simplest categories of the capitalist mode of production, the commodity and money, the mystificatory character that transforms the social relations for which the material elements of wealth serve as bearers in the course of production into properties of these things themselves, commodities. And still more explicitly transforms the relation of production itself into a thing, money. All forms of society participate in this distortion insofar as they involve commodity production and monetary circulation." Then Marx explains that in the era of capital, the distortion of real relations develops even further. But then he says that, however, insofar as capital appears in the process of production as an extractor of surplus value, the real relations are actually pretty visible. He says the same in his discussion of the absolute surplus value in the chapter on the working day. He quotes factory inspectors who talk about small thefts of capital from the laborer's meal and recreation time. "It is evident that in this atmosphere, the formation of surplus value by surplus labor is no secret." So in difference to absolute surplus value production, of course, in the production of relative surplus value, things change. Relative surplus value seems to arise from capital and not from labor. Capital becomes mystical being, since all the productive forces of social labor appear attributable to it and not to labor. So now if we consider West Germany in 68, after the Second World War, of course, we know West German working class had benefited from the increase of the productivity of labor also. And in difference to this day, today the methods of absolute surplus value production, like lengthening of the working day or intensification of labor, are again very apparently used and also in Germany. Let's go further in Capital. So the most important fetishized form in Capital, I would claim, is the wage form. Wage is the value form of the means of subsistence of a worker. Like variable capital is the value form of the means of subsistence of the working class. So Marx writes that the wage form, I quote, "makes the actual relation invisible and shows the direct opposite of that relation, forms the basis of all the mystifications of capitalist mode of production." In the second volume of Capital, Marx explains how the circulation time limits time capital spends in the production process yearly. So the longer the process of circulation takes, the less time capital spends in valorization process. He writes, "but political economy sees only what is apparent, namely the effect of the time of circulation on capital's process of the creation of surplus value in general. It seems to furnish proof that capital possesses a mystic source of self-expansion independent of the exploitation of labor." So the annual rate of surplus value depends on the turnover time of capital. And if the turnover time is short, then the same sum of money can valorize itself in the process of production several times. So the process of the formation of the yearly rate of surplus value creates an illusion that surplus value actually originates in circulation, which is a fetishistic form of thinking. The next step that is veiling the source of surplus value in labor is the formation of the profit rate, of course. So because of the formation of the general profit rate, I quote, normal average profit itself seems to be seems immanent in capital independently of exploitation. So there seems to be no connection between an investment in variable capital and profit. And then further, of course, commercial capital also participates in surplus value distribution without participating into its production. And this further confuses what's going on. Then industrial capitalists have to pay interests. Marx writes that the form of surplus value ossifies to the extreme against its substance. Profit of enterprise seems to accrue from labor of the capitalist himself, and the interest seems to be a natural yield of capital. And finally, of course, the monopoly over the land, which secures the landed property a portion of the produced surplus value, creates an illusion that the natural element itself, land, yields money. So what I aim to show here is that from the chapter 4 on, all the phenomena that are related to fetishism, they are relating to this relation, capital relation, relation between capital and wage labor. Not so in the first three chapters. So I come to my conclusion. It seems to me that the readers of Capital in Frankfurt were talking quite a lot about fetishism in the most general sense, and the fetishism of commodities and money. I bet that they all disagree with me, but I argue that the fetishism of commodities and money in Marxist theory apply, or at least can be applied at any form of commodity production into a greater or lesser degree. And I am now asking, that was this emphasis because then the critique of fetishism of commodities and money could also be directed towards the Eastern Bloc? I'm not sure about this, but I'm asking. If this is the case, then this is a very interesting question. So the question is that why did the commodity production prevail in the state socialist experiments, and what kind of options would there have been? I think anyway that there were also other good reasons for the emphasis of this concept in 68 in West Germany. Most importantly, of course, the problem of the radical students was that the working class seemed to be quite happy to live in a capitalist society. And this means that the revolutionary mood of the students clashed with these objective conditions of the working class. In such an exceptional historical conditions, reading Capital with the focus on the problem of fetishism was, I bet, much more interesting than the emphasis on the theory of surplus value. I think, however, that what was modern once is not necessarily so anymore. So today the methods of absolute surplus value extraction are becoming more and more central also in Germany. So the intensification of work and lengthening of the working day. And when this is done, then the real relations are becoming more and more visible. And therefore, I think it makes sense again to claim that Marx's book is about profiting at the expense of wage labor, and that his concept of fetishism in Capital is important, but it's important mainly because it helps to veil exploitation. Thank you.